This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Changing the voting procedure. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Following the recent midterm election, should the U.S. now move to a system where we can vote online? A tech analyst explains how it can be done securely.
If your company is steering clear of a holiday party this year, it's not alone. Hear the main reason for the pullback.
On the personal finance front, the unanswered questions about investing during a period of big swings in the stock market.
And the refuge in upstate New York, where animals who escape slaughterhouses can live in peace.
Every summer, or not even just the summer, but once or twice a year, there's a police chase that captivates all New Yorkers. And it involves either a bull, a goat, or a cow that has escaped and is, you know, running as if their life is on the line, because it is.
Wall Street Journal reporter Zolan Kano Young's on the Lifestyle 180 for some lucky animals and the family behind their care. He's here later in the hour. Even with Democrats taking control of the House, there were silver linings for President Trump following the midterms earlier this week. House Democrats will now provide a foil for the president, providing him with an enemy to blame for any policy failures, and in particular for any economic decline that might follow after years of steady economic growth. More from Wall Street Journal Executive Washington Editor Jerry Seib. Jerry, how do you see it?
What he really needed to do was avoid disaster. It was bound to be a good night for the Democrats. I think the best hope that the Republicans and the president had was to prevent it from being a really great night for Democrats. And that's kind of what happened. They held on to the Senate, obviously. They've probably picked up, not clear, a seat, a couple of seats, maybe three seats. There's some races to be decided. But that was always the key for Republicans. Keep control of the Senate, even if you lose control of the House. And they lost some governorships, Republicans did, in the upper Midwest. That's a problem, but they didn't see the big marquee races that Democrats most wanted to win. The governor's race and the senator's race in Florida, the governor's race in Georgia, where an African-American woman, Stacey Abrams, was trying to become a really historic figure. Those didn't go the Democrats' way. And as a result, I think the president emerged with, as they say, what he needed to have, which was continued control of the Senate, and a wave that was a Democratic wave, but not a giant one.
Do we still have the feel of 2016 here in 2018?
I think we are pretty much exactly where we were in 2016, in many ways, only more so. The biggest difference between 2016 and 2018 is you had suburban women in particular go from being sort of marginal Democratic voters or non-voters at all to being stronger Democratic voters and not Republican voters, and that tipped the balance in a series of close House races. And you have otherwise blue areas acting more blue for the Democrats, red areas acting more red, more Republican, and more Trumpy, if you will, than they did in 2016. And so you have a kind of a cementing in place of the same general results. You know, 2016 was also a split decision, if you want, which is Donald Trump won the Electoral College but lost the popular vote. Hillary Clinton for the Democrats won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College. It's in a way the same kind of split decision we had. House goes one way, Senate goes the other way.
We're speaking with Jerry Seib, Wall Street Journal Executive Washington Editor, about his piece entitled Trump Did What He Needed to Do in the Midterms. You referenced, too, maybe the president finds his bipartisan side here.
So the interesting question is what happens in Washington now, and I think policy paralysis is the obvious, easy analysis, and I think there will be a fair amount of that. I think the more interesting question is, at least at the beginning, are there a couple of places where the Democrats who now control the House and the Republican president, Donald Trump, find that they have a way to cooperate on a few things, at least, to show that they're interested in getting some things done. They'll both have an interest in that. And I think there are a couple of possibilities. One is spending on infrastructure. Democrats want that. The president has wanted that. They don't seem to care, either group, all that much about running up the deficit a little bit more to do that spending. And so that's one possibility. They both have talked a lot about reining in prescription drug prices, finding ways to put a lid on prescription drug prices. So maybe there's room for cooperation on that front as well. It'll be fascinating to see the dynamic between President Trump on the one hand and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. There's certainly no love lost there. They've had plenty of harsh things to say about each other. Now we'll find out if they can, under these circumstances, find ways to work together.
Will the harshness soften at all?
You know, the president said a couple of interesting things in recent days about, well, maybe I want to soften my tone. You know, he can do it if he wants to. All he has to do is do it. So we'll see. In terms of Democrats, I think one of the tests for them is, will the House Democrats want to basically spend all of their time investigating, subpoenaing, and talking about impeachment of the president? Or do they want to show the party base that they're going to be tough on the Trump administration on things like, you know, Russian interference in the 2016 election and kind of ethics issues, but not get carried away and still do some governing business at the same time.
All right. So just looking at his history, by the way, of victories, a crowded presidential primary, a general presidential election, and really minimizing the damage on a midterm night, is he a master strategist?
Oh, I wouldn't go quite that far. I mean, look, he did a smart thing. He planted his flag in a few states to make sure Republican senators or Senate candidates won in those places. Indiana, Tennessee, Missouri, and that seemed to have worked. He turned out his base in big numbers, and that was enough to tip the balance in those states, and in a couple of them did more than tip the balance to give Republicans somewhat surprisingly comfortable wins. That was a good thing, and he did it successfully. It was a kind of an obvious thing to do. The point is that it worked, and it's, again, to go back to the beginning of the conversation, it prevented Republicans from facing disaster and kept a good Democratic night from becoming a great one.
Thanks, Jerry. Wall Street Journal Executive Washington Editor Jerry Seib. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Voting should obviously be one of the most important things we do on a regular basis in our lives, yet too many of us don't. Would putting the process online improve participation? Here's tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group, on how it could be done. Rob, how difficult would it be?
Well, not as difficult as you might think. Technology certainly exists. The kind of technology that we use for both medical and banking could be applied here. So we've done a lot of work to both create systems of scale and to secure them. And, of course, that's been the big concern with regard to putting elections online, is whether or not you could secure them. But right now, we could probably secure an online election far better than we can secure a traditional election, because the pure complexity of a traditional election that works against any security process. And you could certainly compromise an election today in any one of a number of ways. And since we don't really know how our votes are received, there's really no complete audit step to make sure that our votes are counted or counted correctly right now. Yeah. So we've had, you know, a lot of problems like the hang chat problem in Florida and a lot of unfortunate issues with regard to voters being unable to vote or votes being inaccurately counted or ballots lost.
I don't think there's any doubt the technology is there, right? I mean, as you said, banking, you know, social media sites, health insurance information, medical care. But I think the big selling point would be, how could we convince Americans that things are completely secure and fair and accurate?
Well, since Americans probably right now aren't convinced that existing systems are fair and accurate, I think the bar is probably pretty low with regard to convincing them that something might be better than what they've got. Certainly a lot of folks feel that their votes aren't being adequately counted, and we've got a major problem with those of us on the West Coast feeling that, our votes don't contribute at all, because a lot of elections at a national level are decided before the before we even get a chance to vote, which is kind of problematic. And with an online election, you could open it up for several days ahead of the election, and then everybody votes, and then you don't start reporting the votes until the election day occurs, and now everybody's treated more equally, and the folks on the West Coast can compete with the folks on the East Coast, and both of them can count and have equal weight. Because, you know, once you figure an election's over and your person's lost, why go to the polls? Which, of course, is kind of problematic. You're really talking about democracy.
How about the verification of voters being who they say they are?
Well, we've got something called blockchain. And blockchain, which came to us through cryptocurrency, is a relatively secure, highly accurate way to verify that both individual and the voting entity are who they say they are, and so you don't become compromised. It's very difficult to violate. And since we're talking about state-level actors, in other words, countries like China and Russia trying to alter the outcome of elections, then something like blockchain is what we need to alter that. Because when you're talking, you know, state-level problems, you're talking up to $1 trillion could be spent to compromise an election. And so that kind of money, you could pretty much compromise anything that's done with lots of people. The only thing that it might not affect is something that was electronic and properly secured.
What do you think that does to voter participation if we were ever to go completely online?
Well, it would increase. In Oregon, where I'm from, the primary way of voting is actually through the mail. And so our turnouts are about 50% higher than everybody else's, because it's just a ton more convenient. And so if you go online, that makes it more convenient still, and that would increase the turnout rather dramatically.
If there were a commitment to this, what would a realistic launch year be? Could you do it in time for 2020 if you really wanted to?
Oh, no, you absolutely could. A number of countries have done this already. There was a big move back in the 2000s to do that, but back then the security just wasn't ready for the effort. But that's, of course, improved since then. But, yeah, we could do it by 2020. We could probably do it by next year if we wanted to. Remember, the Obamacare rollout, which wasn't all that great, was far more difficult than doing an election. And granted, it broke at first, but they were able to fix it within 2 years. And we've learned an awful lot since then about rolling out complex systems, and this wouldn't even need to be all that complex.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the technology advisory firm called The Enderle Group. It is 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Learn about the best state to start or grow your business at michiganbusiness.org. There seems to be a Grinch-like approach to companies and their annual holiday parties this year. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
If you're expecting a big holiday bash at your company this year because the economy's doing well, think again. We're speaking with MarketWatch's Andrew Keschner. Andrew, what percentage of companies are planning parties? What does it look like now?
Right now, it's about 65% of companies, and that's according to a survey of about 150 HR reps from 150 companies.
And how different is that from years past?
That is definitely down. It looks to be that it was about hovering around, 75%, as high as 75% back in 2016. The lowest was 62%, and that was 2009, right when everyone was struggling with the Great Recession.
So, Andrew, what's the story? Why are some companies shying away from holiday parties?
It's not exactly 100% clear, but the people doing the survey have a good guess that a lot of it has to do with the Me Too movement and concerns from companies about, throwing parties where there's alcohol and creating situations where, workers exposing themselves to sexual misconduct, that sort of a thing.
So alcohol certainly had been around at these parties for quite a while. So is it really the Me Too movement, or are there some underlying other problems with alcohol?
It's not clear, at least from this, because the number of people, the number of companies that say they're still having parties, they're not cutting back on alcohol. In fact, many of the companies who are still hanging on to the parties this year are actually increasing their budget for the parties, and none are reducing their budget. So it's not quite clear.
We're speaking with MarketWatch's Andrew Keschner. Andrew, there are some other stories or other reasons cited in your story for why some companies are not having holiday parties, including the fact that a lot of workforces are spread around. How is that affecting things?
It's not really fun to have a soiree via Skype. If everyone's all, telecommuting from various places, it's tough to wrangle everyone together into one place at one time. And another reason that the survey is thinking about is maybe parties at another time of year. And this is my speculation. Maybe they're hoping to just get a better deal on on a venue, not in the holiday season. Who knows?
And what does the economy have an effect on these parties? Are companies not wanting to spend money right now?
Well, you would think maybe they'd be a little bit more easier with the cash because it's, by a lot of measures, a really good economy right now. It's been a bull market for 9 years. Unemployment is low. We are about almost a year or so into the implementation of tax cuts at the federal level that, you would think would be reaping a lot of tax savings for companies. So you'd think they'd be willing to, pony up.
Andrew, we've heard a lot of stories about behavior gone awry because of alcohol or other reasons or flirting or inappropriate relationships or whatever. But what are some of the benefits of having a holiday party?
I guess the benefit, one of the biggest things that the survey definitely points to is just getting your coworkers together and that team building exercise of just kind of being together and building those relationships as a team, when it goes all well and there's no alcohol fueled shenanigans or something like that. But at its best, it's meant to just build that cohesion.
That is MarketWatch reporter Andrew Keschner with this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka. It is 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. The vast majority of people across the country have some form of debt, but that path to financial freedom can look awfully bleak when you have high interest debt. And if your FICO score isn't great, it can make breaking out of that revolving debt cycle harder than it needs to be. Thankfully, our sponsor Upstart is revolutionizing the process of personal lending. Upstart offers personal loans, but they're not like the ones your bank or credit union provides. That's because Upstart goes beyond the traditional FICO score when assessing your creditworthiness. They actually reward you based on your education and your job history in the form of a smarter interest rate. 2 minutes is all it takes to go online and find out your Upstart rate. Hurry to upstart.com/Gordon to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes 2 minutes and won't affect your credit. That's upstart.com/Gordon. Check it out today, upstart.com/Gordon. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, some unanswered questions for investors given the recent market volatility. Also, slaughterhouse refugees have a country place in upstate New York. We'll tell you about it and the family that runs it, and how three strangers in Houston came together to ensure that one of them could vote. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Are you in the market for some new wheels? Here's what's trending from USAA auto industry expert Jimmy Spears, who's here with tips and insights for buying a new car. Jimmy, what are the vehicles maybe capturing a lot of our attention these days?
Well, at USAA, the vehicles that capture the attention of the military and their families are trucks. Trucks absolutely rule the day at USAA. Leading off is Ford F-150, number two is Dodge Ram, and then number three is the Chevy Silverado.
Is it true that you actually broke this down by the vehicles purchased mostly by a certain military branch?
We did. We're very fortunate, USA. We have 11.7 million members. And with that, we're, again, very fortunate to be able to service all the branches of the military. So we did take a look at all of them. And the number one truck or the number one vehicle for all of them is the Ford F-150,
yeah.
Except for the Marines. They chose the Dodge Ram as being number one.
Is that right?
It is.
I guess if I had my choice, it would be great to break it down, like I do a deep dive on the data and say, I want to drive what a guy from the 101st Airborne Division drives. Or I want to drive what a Navy SEAL drives. That's the data we got to have.
I'm certain that we could get that if we needed to.
Tell me about why these guys are after the trucks. Is it just the thing these days? We like size?
Well, number one, trucks are just so practical. And I guess the best way you could think about it, I was fortunate enough to serve 13 years in the U.S. Army. And trucks are just the ultimate team type of a vehicle. And that's what the military is all about. There are a lot of military members that are moving. I grew up as a military brat, and I'll tell you, we moved 12 times during my father's career.
Yeah.
So this, you help each other out when you're moving a lot, and trucks are very practical for that.
Yeah. Autonomous cars, the self-driving things, how far away are we from, like, widespread use?
Well, I'll tell you, that's we don't really have an official stance on that at USA, but personally, I would suggest that you look at what the legislative activity has. If once you start to see more laws passing that allow those on the highway, the sooner you're going to see them on the streets. Because right now there's just a few jurisdictions in the country that allow them, and that's where some experimentation is going on. However, there's a lot of semi-autonomous features, driver-assisted automated driver devices that are going on. Chevrolet, the Cadillac division, has an incredible system, which is called Super Cruise. A light will come on your dash. It'll be green when you're on a segment that's already been mapped out by the engineers. It allows you to take your hands off the wheel, but not your eyes off the road.
Yeah.
If your eyes break a little bit off the road, you got to put your hands back on the wheel. But you are going to start to see a lot of semi-autonomous features coming on vehicles.
We're speaking with Jimmy Spears, USAA auto industry expert, talking about what's trending and also insights for buying a car. Speaking of which, the winter season, you say, is actually a better time to buy a car?
It is. There's a few things that are happening this time of year. First thing is that we have the new models that are coming out. 2019s are coming in, and those 2018s need to be moved. There's a number of incentives, number of rebates, but then also a number of manufacturers are doing some, again, incentives with interest rates. So we would really like our members, in fact, the general public, everyone, to make sure that they use the technology that's in their hand. Just don't depend on technology in cars, but do take a look at the technology that we have that helps us with our vehicle search and also our total cost of ownership.
You think at some point, Jimmy, we get to a point where we don't even have to go to a dealer? Well, I think there are at least a couple of apps right now that help you buy your vehicle online and just gets delivered right to your driveway.
Well, there's already a few companies that do that. But technically, you're still going through a dealer because there are dealership laws that are on the books, so you must go through a dealer. But however, these dealers are very creative. These dealers, and you take a company like Carvana, you can pick it out online, and then they can actually drop it off and deliver it to your driveway. But I'll tell you this, many of your local dealerships will do that for you as well as a service.
Yeah, just got to ask. That's the key. Thank you, Jimmy. Appreciate it. Jimmy Spears, USAA auto industry experts. It is 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. The S&P is still down a handful of percentage points from its September all-time high. Indeed, U.S. stocks just suffered their worst monthly loss since 2011. What should we make of the craziness? Personal finance expert Jonathan Clements at HumbleDollar.com has a look at some unanswered questions. Jonathan, set this up.
Well, there's been a lot of questions about the direction of the financial markets in recent weeks. We're still down a fair amount from the late September high, and people are asking a bunch of different questions, and probably the biggest question out there is, which way is the stock market headed? And I like to tell people, if you ask a stupid question, you'll get a stupid answer. Mm. The fact is, none of us has a crystal ball, have no idea which way the markets are headed. So instead of focusing on a question that you can't answer, it's better to focus on questions you can answer. And when it comes to the direction of the stock market, instead of trying to guess whether share prices are heading up or down, what you should really do is ask about risk in two different senses. Are you taking more or less risk than you should, given your objective financial situation, meaning, you know, are you retired? Are you still in the workforce? What sort of time horizon do you have? Think about that, and that'll tell you whether you should be more in stocks or less so. And similarly, the other risk question you should ask about is how much risk can you stomach? You don't want to be that person who's heavily invested in the stock market drops 20%, and suddenly you discover that you're not quite as big and brave as you imagined.
What was the point you made about the great rotation, and has it begun?
This is really an interesting question, I believe. You know, what we've seen in recent years is this huge gains by growth stocks. We all know the names, Amazon, Netflix, Apple, you know, Google's Alphabet, Facebook. And a lot of people have ended up heavily invested in these stocks. Meanwhile, so-called value stocks, you know, those sort of companies tend to be beaten down, trade at, you know, low price earnings ratios, tend to trade at low prices relative to the value of their assets. Those stocks have not done well in recent years. But a funny thing's happened in the last 6 or 7 weeks. What we've seen is that the big, well-known growth stocks have fallen a lot. Meanwhile, these value stocks have actually held up pretty well. And it could be that we're starting to see this great rotation out of the growth stocks and into the value stocks. And if it happens, it's long overdue. We've just had the longest dry spell for value stocks ever. So it may be time for a little bit of catch-up. If you've got a portfolio that's heavily tilted towards growth stocks, you don't have too many value managers in your portfolio, maybe it's time to go out and buy some of those value stock funds.
And back up a second. What would those look like? What, you know, value stocks versus growth stocks?
Well, the easiest way to buy some of these value stocks is to go out and buy some of those value index mutual funds, iShares, Vanguard, Spiders. They all have some of these value stock index funds. You buy one of these funds and you can get a couple of hundred value stocks in a single portfolio at, you know, relatively low expense ratio.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor at HumbleDollar.com. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, on a massive compound in upstate New York, some 800 fugitives while away their days, basking in the sun while a 24-hour staff caters to their needs. They're escapees from a city slaughterhouse. The Farm Sanctuary, as it's called, has housed 1,100 various animals, 5 cows and bulls, 14 ducks, 3 geese, 15 rabbits, 5 pigs, 8 turkeys, a handful of sheep, 25 goats that got away from New York City slaughterhouses. Wall Street Journal reporter Zolan Kano Youngs paid a visit to the nearly 300-acre farm in Watkins Glen, New York. Zolan, give us a brief setup.
There's always these traditions in New York City, these annual events. And I've noticed, just as I've been on this beat, that it seems like every summer, or not even just the summer, but once or twice a year, there's a police chase that captivates all New Yorkers. And it involves either a bull, a goat, or a cow that has escaped and is, you know, running as if their life is on the line, because it is, yeah, going through the streets of Queens or Brooklyn, maybe knocking down a couple people, running past storefronts. Everybody's documenting it on their cell phones. You know, TV networks dispatch their cameramen and sometimes their helicopters to give live feeds of it. And it just happens so many times that in the most recent time, when two goats escaped, we still don't know which slaughterhouse they escaped from, but, you know, all these officials say that they probably escaped from a slaughterhouse. That's the trend. When, if you remember, they were running on the N train subway track line, causing subway delays.
Yeah.
And then Jon Stewart, the Daily Show host, comes to get them. And I remembered that a couple years ago, Jon Stewart came and corralled a bull in Queens. I was like, what if all of these animals that escape these slaughterhouses all end up in the same place? Wouldn't that be the paradise sanctuary for all of these fugitives, if you will? And it turns out that was the case. So we took a little trip up there, and it was one of the more pleasant and tranquil reporting editions I've had.
We're speaking with Zolan Kano Youngs, Wall Street Journal New York law enforcement reporter. He's kind of off the beaten path here with this piece, writing about escape from New York. Slaughterhouse refugees have a country place, and he's written about a 275-acre farm about 5 hours northwest of New York City, where animals who escape slaughterhouses are roaming free these days. How does the woman or the people in charge support all that? There's like 800 something animals.
Yeah. I mean, they speak very highly. I think they're getting a lot of support from donors. You know, there's a lot of people out there, in all seriousness, who feel that, you know, these animals, that they deserve a chance at life. They're receiving a good amount of donations and financial support from people that truly believe in the work the sanctuary is doing. It's worth noting, though, however, that, you know, let's be honest, these guys, you know, who work in these slaughterhouses and these, they're making a living, you know, as well in Queens and Brooklyn. So, you know, we're the journal, and we got to be objective, of course. And even for a hilarious piece like this, you know, I think I cold called some of those slaughterhouses, and, you know, none of those guys have any bad intentions. They're just trying to make a good living as well.
Thanks, Zolan. Wall Street Journal reporter Zolan Cano Youngs. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, a first-time voter, a volunteer, and a photographer converge to make a moment on Election Day. HoustoniaMag.com says that a polling place in Houston, a photographer named Daniel Kramer, watched an older Hispanic lady pull up to the Ripley Center. Along comes Jenny Ceballos, an elections volunteer. She starts talking to the woman. Ms. Barcenas, who gets out of the car, told Ms. Ceballos that she wasn't sure where to vote, so she came to the Ripley Center hoping they could help her. Ms. Ceballos, a realtor, in addition to being a political volunteer, pulled out her phone, found the correct voting location, but just as she was about to look up directions, her phone died, so she turned to Mr. Kramer, the photographer, and asked if she could borrow his cell phone. He handed it over. She found the map. Ms. Ceballos offered to drive Ms. Barcenas because she was afraid she'd get the directions she was trying to memorize. So Mr. Kramer offered to ride along, and the three strangers made the vote happen. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.